Well, last time we talked about church history, we kind of ended with something similar to lions and tigers and bears, oh no, except it was along the lines of emperors and popes and bishops, oh no. There was sort of at the end of the lesson, we talked about how there was a steep decline in the morals, ethics of the church, as well as popes were kind of dying left and right. Some of them, there was a 15-year-old pope. There was a particular woman in Italy who was the lover of a pope at one point. She bore him a child. She saw to it that her family remained in power by manipulating that pope and others. Eventually, at one point, the love child of the pope and this his mistress became the pope later. I mean, it just, right, yeah. Emperors and bishops and popes, oh no, it was an incredible mess. And as we said at the end of that lesson, that made good people in Europe long for reform and for change and for renewal. So we are going to talk about, and we're going to talk about some of that quote unquote renewal. You can judge for yourself whether it was much of a renewal or not, but we will see that for sure there was a great increase in power vested in the pope or the popes in succession. And certainly many things did change. We are going to try to cover a lot of territory today because I'm kind of tired of talking about this, the ups and downs of Roman Catholicism, all right? But I don't want to leave out something that's important. This is part of my personality. It's hard for me to not be thorough. I'm just going to try to be thorough faster, all right? Normally, I try to cover about one chapter in the textbook that I'm using. The notes for today are three chapters. So fasten on your seatbelts, and here we go. So starting in 909, there was some reform and renewal among the various monasteries. If you have something to say, do you not to say it out loud? What? No, I don't think I do. Oh, wife of mine. Don't you have a class to teach or something yourself? All right, so here we go. All right, so in 909, some reforms began among the monks and the nuns in the monastic sort of lifestyle, and it was known as the Cluniac reforms. And what that, there was a particular guy, William, Duke William of Aquitaine. He started a monastery, and he set aside his favorite hunting grounds, which were called Cluny. Or maybe Cluny. I don't know how to say all of these words anyway, but whatever. He set aside his favorite hunting grounds as the territory of this monastery. So he built the building. He set aside land for them so that they could sustain themselves with farming, right? And he made one very important decision. He put into like the deed that this was under the control of St. Peter and St. Paul, which meant the Pope. It meant the ongoing line, the succession of popes, which meant that the local bishops and the local authorities, either religious or civil, could not influence the inner workings of this monastery. So it removed it from the local politics. Okay, does that kind of make sense? And that allowed these monks to kind of carry on their business without much interference at all. And he wanted it to be a place of true religious piety. All right? And their influence spread really throughout Europe. They were obedient to the rule of Saint Benedict. You remember we've talked about that before. They did what they were supposed to do. All right? Now, let me just kind of change the topic briefly here for a second. Then in 1049, Leo IX became the pope. he also promoted reform. He wanted there to be two primary areas of reform. He also wanted monasteries and other church positions and properties to be relieved from the influence of local politics or, you know, local nobility. He wanted that. And so essentially what was happening was, is positions within the church were being sold. So you could become an abbot of a monastery, or you could become a bishop of a region if you could buy the position. And you bought it. It was because of the need for money, the wealthy nobility at the time had a lot of influence on who became bishops and abbots of monasteries and that sort of thing. So it just becomes that the church feels like it's a pawn in the hand of the wealthy landed nobility. And with those positions always came a lot of power, prestige, wealth, and land. So the church owned a lot of land, and the monasteries owned a lot of land, and they became very wealthy. And so if you could buy the position of abbot for yourself or for a friend, then you had access to all of that wealth and the production of wealth. So he wanted, and that the selling of those positions was called simony. He wanted to end simony, and he wanted to promote or even require clerical celibacy. So we've talked about in this class that Catholic priests were not required to be celibate for many centuries. However, monks were required. That was always a part of their vows. So the problem was, here's kind of what happened. The wealthy nobility and some honest, lowly priests became allies against Pope Leo IX because these lowly, ordinary priests still had wives, many of them. They still had wives. So you couldn't be a bishop and have a wife, apparently, I think, if I remember correctly. But these ordinary, sort of lowly parish priests, many of them still had wives, and these high-rolling nobility guys, they didn't want the Pope messing with their land and their power and their influence, so they kind of joined forces and delayed any of this reform. Of course, we also know that sometimes these, along with the requirement of celibacy, it didn't only mean you couldn't have a wife, it also meant you couldn't have a harem, right? And so in some sense, he's trying to require celibacy because he wants these priests to stop keeping lovers as well. All right. Eventually, all of this led to open conflict between another pope down the line, Pope Gregory VII, and the Emperor Henry IV. So kind of what happened is there was a riot, and the cause of the riot were some people, just rank-and-file people, that wanted to enforce clerical celibacy. So I don't know what this riot was like, but I could imagine that they went into priests' homes and took away their wives. Okay, so there was some rioting going on. And Henry, the emperor, Henry IV, put down the riot and deposed the bishop of this particular region, the area of Milan. He deposed the bishop for not handling this situation better. All right? Well, the Pope, Pope Gregory VII, says, "You can't do that. That's my job. If I want to get rid of him, if I want to fire a bishop, I do the firing around here." And so they end up in this ongoing kind of conflict. Gregory excommunicates the emperor and condemns him to hell if he doesn't repent. I'm not sure that bothered Henry a whole lot, but for various reasons, mostly political, because he needed to maintain his power and his influence with the rank-and-file people who do pay attention to what the Pope says, he ends up on the steps of the papal mansion for 3 days begging for an audience with the Pope, and the Pope is humiliating him. Remember, we've kind of seen this happen before. Back in Roman times, there would be a bishop. In fact, it was a bishop of Milan that did this. They would humiliate the Pope. I mean, he'll humiliate the emperor, you know, in some way. Well, this is an emperor from Germany, but nevertheless, the Pope is humiliating him by forcing him to beg to even be allowed in the doors. He is, you know, legend has it there was snow on the steps, that it was snowing, he was freezing and shivering, and he's the emperor, for crying out loud, but the Pope won't let him in. Eventually, he was allowed in, and he did receive pardon, but only, not because the Pope wanted to give it to him, but the Pope couldn't really claim to be a representative of Christ if he didn't offer forgiveness of sins. And so he did finally receive that pardon. And then here's kind of what happened. He goes back home, and there's, because of not really having the vote of confidence of the Pope, people are rising up against him in rebellion, the emperor, they're rising up against him. The Pope decides not to take sides. You know, he's wanting to continue to humiliate Henry IV, the emperor. As it turns out, Henry gains the ascendancy. He starts to win, and the Pope is stubborn, and he backs the rebel emperor, the one who's rising up against Henry. Eventually, Henry completely wins the civil war, and then he decides to march on Rome as soon as he could go through the Alps. As soon as the ice had thawed enough for him to get through the mountain passes, he goes and marches on Rome. And Gregory has very few allies. The Pope has very few allies at this point, except some folks down in the south of Italy who are Normans. And it turns out he happened to have excommunicated them prior to this as well. So, you know, again, we kind of say to ourselves, what a mess. You know, there's just this, the mixing of politics and religion creates an unholy mess. Eventually, Henry V takes his father's place in 1106, and there continues to be this conflict. Eventually, what happens, mostly because there was a new pope, his name is Calixtus II, he happened to be related to the current emperor at the time, and they get together and they create something called the Concordat of Worms in 1122. So bishops are no longer appointed at that point by the emperor, and there was some exchanging of land and power and that sort of thing. And eventually the pope and the emperors stop this sort of ongoing religious, political wrangling and war. Also, the Concordat of Worms is how they ended simony. So there was no longer the selling and buying of these religious high positions, and clerical celibacy was required universally in the Catholic Church. This, all of this served to basically increase the power of the Pope. All right, any comments or questions on all of that? So I ask you, did this represent spiritual renewal and reform? Religious? really, I think from our Protestant perspective, we would basically say no. It is an ongoing movement of the increase of the power of the Pope, essentially is what it is. There may have been some good things along the way. However, there doesn't seem to be much progress as we would count progress. All right? Well, from that dark chapter, let's turn and talk about the Crusades, shall we? So, and I have a little map that you can refer to on the next page. There's a lot that could be said about the Crusades. You know, some people talk about the Third Crusade, the Fourth Crusade, the Fifth Crusade, maybe even as many as more than that. It's kind of hard to divide them all up. But we perhaps should say a few things about the First Crusade. So, in 1095, Pope Urban II declared the First Crusade. His desire was, and this is kind of a cool phrase, I didn't put it in the notes, his desire was to have one church under one shepherd, the Pope. Okay? And remember how we have talked about, for a very long time, the church in the West was kind of weak. No, I'm sorry. It was strong because the empire was kind of weak, and the church in the West was strengthening and was kind of filling the vacuum. And then we remember how we said that the empire in the East, the Byzantine Empire, was quite strong, and it typically kept the church under its thumb. Well, the West really had no opportunity because it had a weak political structure, divided, weak empire. It had no opportunity to influence the church in the East because of the strong empire, the strong government over it. Now, as we progress through time, as we get to sort of the turn of the millennium here at 1095-ish, the government in the Byzantine Empire is beginning to weaken. All right? And so now there's kind of this opportunity for the Western church to influence the Eastern church because the Eastern Empire is weakening. It's beginning to weaken. It is threatened by the Muslim invasions. So the goal of Pope Urban II and previous popes to him, but Pope Urban II is the one who is able to kind of bring this to pass, is to unite the Western and the Eastern churches, to influence the Eastern church if they can, as well as to retake Jerusalem from the Muslims. So let's get some influence in Constantinople on our way. So you can kind of see on the map, they went through Constantinople. On our way to Jerusalem, let's pass through Constantinople and let's gain some influence there. So, after they had gone through, you can see this again on the map, after they had gone through Constantinople, they besieged Antioch on their way to Jerusalem. And there was this weird episode in the siege of Antioch. They, some Armenian Christians, all right, that's not a theological Armenian, it's ethnic Armenians, okay, which you're familiar with from the news sometimes. The Armenian Christians on the inside of the walls of Antioch, they opened the gates and let the crusaders in. But the Muslims went to the citadel. They went to kind of a fortress within the walls of Antioch. And they had plenty of supplies, and the invaders, the crusaders, did not. So they're stuck. They have they're in for a long siege, and they're not prepared for a long siege. Well, a prophet-like seer, you know, we might call him a fanatic, okay? He has a quote-unquote vision that the spear that pierced Christ's side is buried somewhere inside the walls of Antioch, the city of Antioch. And he does a little hocus-pocus, and he takes the people to a spot and says, dig here, and guess what they dig up? A spear. Okay, now, you know, you got to wonder about how this went down, you know. But nevertheless, they dig up this ancient-looking spear, and they begin to believe that God is with them in this siege. And so they fight like absolute fanatics, and they actually win. These crusading armies are brutal, and they seem to be quite proud of the fact that when the Turks left, so these are Turkish Muslims that are defending Antioch and some parts of Palestine, but not Jerusalem itself. But anyway, those Turkish Muslims left behind all their women. You know, I don't know why they did that, but they did. They fled for their lives and left behind their women. And these crusaders were quite proud of the fact that they did not rape the Turkish women. They only ran them through with a sword. So, So that's the second, that's the back page of the notes there at the little frowny face, okay? All right. So then this crusade moves on south. This first crusade, the troops move on south to besiege Jerusalem starting in June. Really, they started in June of 1099. All right. In July, the crusaders received news that a large Arab army was approaching. And they begged God to bless their invasion because they had to hurry it up. They even marched around the city barefooted as a sign of penitence, and they sang hymns of penitence as they were marching around the city. So I think that's a combination of trying to reenact the story of Jericho and feeling badly that they had killed all these women. All right, back up the road. Anyway, when the attack began, the resistance was very, very strong. However, there was a single knight, and in my textbook, he was an unnamed knight. I don't know if there's any legends or any record of who this guy was, but a single knight was able to get up on the wall, All right, and he held a position on the walls of Jerusalem and was able to, by kind of clearing out a spot on the wall, he was able to then provide a space for other soldiers to get over the wall. Once the breach grew to a significant degree, the resistance within the city melted away, and all of these defenders of Jerusalem, the Muslim defenders of Jerusalem, were all killed. They were massacred. The crusaders also killed many civilians, raped many women, and bashed babies against the walls of the city. So they killed babies by just brute trauma, brute force against walls of the city. So that is why the Crusades have such a terrible name. There were many Crusades that followed. The initial success of the First Crusade was really never repeated, and it was mostly only because the Muslims were divided among themselves. So once they got their act together, they were able, after 100 years, to retake Jerusalem and to pretty much defend their territory. And there were many, many, many other sort of atrocities along the way. So once we get to the Second Crusade and the Third Crusade, I believe it was in the Second Crusade, someone decided that along the way, Jews should also be exterminated. So they're going and finding Jewish villages and people in cities that are Jews, and they brutally murder and exterminate them as well. The Second Crusade also involved children because the leaders said God values innocence. And so children marched off to these crusades expecting that out of the mouth of babes, God would declare his victory. Most of those children never even made it to Jerusalem or anywhere else where there was a battle. They starved many of them or were taken as slaves along the way. The only crusade that had some level of success was a crusade that was called for. So if you remember, the Muslims had powered their way all the way through northern Africa. They crossed at the Straits of Gibraltar and went north up into Spain. So they are already now, they are invading Western Europe. And for hundreds of years, they controlled much of Spain. So eventually there was a crusade called for to retake Spain, which they did accomplish. So that was the one other relatively successful crusade, was the crusade to retake Spain and to remove the Muslims from power. Now, they didn't remove all the Muslims completely, but they did remove them from power. It was no longer part of the caliphate of the Muslim empire. There were some important consequences of all of this moving around and fighting and that sort of thing. So because of, obviously, an emphasis on the Holy Land and at least some knights going to the Holy Land and surviving and coming back. Okay, some of them survived. Some of them came back. There was an emphasis on the Holy Land, and so consequently, European Christians gave more thought to and devotional emphasis on the life of Christ, the incarnate Word living in, those roads that we saw, and those villages that we saw. They knew it wasn't recently, but they knew that they had been to the land of Christ, and there was kind of a new emphasis on the life of Christ here upon earth and his ministry, his earthly ministry. Also, Europe was flooded with relics. So we know that the Reformation, much of what's going on at the time of Martin Luther, is he is objecting to the veneration of relics, pieces of bone and skulls of saints and pieces of the true cross and all of these different things. They're sort of migrating back. So these people that survived the Crusades and have been in the Holy Land, they are finding a piece of wood and calling it part of the true cross. They're finding pieces of bone and saying that they are bones of the patriarchs and teeth of biblical figures and on you can go. So they are bringing back this emphasis on holy relics that become venerated in the Catholic religion. And then also, the Crusades gave rise to things like the Knights of Templar, or the Order of Templar, and other warfare-related orders. So you could be a particular kind of monk. You could be a Benedictine monk, or later we're going to see you could be a Franciscan monk, or you could be other kinds of monks, and they were called orders, right? And you entered that, you entered holy orders. Well, these soldiers, these knights, they would enter into an order, and it would require obedience, and they were supposed to be Christians, but they weren't religious. It wasn't their occupation to be religious. It was their occupation to fight for the army of the Lord, so to speak. So they made these wars holy wars in that sense, and they even sort of ordained the knights into some sort of quasi-religious order of warfare. And those knights, such as the Knights of Templar, continued to hold significant power even long after the Crusades were ended. And all you need to do to know that for a fact is to watch National Treasure, right? Oh, maybe nobody's watched Nicolas Cage. Yeah, you need to watch Nicolas Cage in National Treasure to know that they even influenced American history, right? Oh, they've got a third one coming out. So their influence continues on to this day. All right. Any comments or questions on the Crusades or anything we've talked about so far this morning? So it's, in many, many ways, it's dark chapter after dark chapter in European history. All right. And part of the darkness is religious darkness. All right. So, medieval Catholicism, however, is really accruing to itself great power. So we saw how, in many ways, the Pope bested the emperor. The Pope's power is increasing in Europe. Then they even have armies underneath them as the Crusades are happening. They use some of these consequences of the Crusades, such as the Knights Templar and other things. They use these relics to be a part of the influence of the church. And so, really, starting at about the 1200s, there are 100 years or so of kind of the zenith of the power of medieval Catholicism. The power of the Pope, the influence of the monasteries, and so forth. So, I want to talk about sort of three primary ways in which this power and influence is expressed or experienced. And then perhaps next week I actually will talk about, just very briefly at the beginning, perhaps we'll even talk a little bit about architecture, because some of the grandest cathedrals of Europe were built during this time, this 1200s and thereafter. And so it's kind of interesting to see their philosophy of what a cathedral was supposed to be and how it represented Christianity and even represented theology and other things. But we'll see if we can get into that next week. So something new began to happen in the monasteries. Because the Crusades reopened these trade routes. So I don't know if you remember, but 2 weeks ago on our last lesson, I mentioned that power and prestige and wealth were concentrated in land. Because of the Muslims cutting off the trade routes to the east and hindering much trade even along the Mediterranean basin, that there wasn't much commerce. So it was not a monetary economy, it was an agricultural economy, and because of that, there wasn't much of a middle class. Well, now that begins to change. And the Crusades have done it. The Crusades have reopened some of those trade routes. Commerce begins to flow again, and it competes, this sort of money economy competes with land as a means of wealth. This led to the rise of cities. So if wealth is all in the land, people spread out and they farm the land, right? If wealth is in a money economy, people congregate together and live in cities. So the city economy is part of this, and that restructures traditional parish ministry. So if what you need is kind of a relatively small number of a priest and maybe some monks, you know, for some sort of local ministry, they do a lot of visitation. You know, people come to church on a regular basis because, you know, they're sick and tired of plowing or whatever. You know, they're coming to church. You know, you just need one local area sort of in a relatively large, you know, feudal area of land. Well, now people are gathering in the cities, and you could have multiple churches in one city because you need to serve the people a little bit better than just everybody cramming into one service on Sunday. And so monks and the monastic orders have, throughout history, they've always been able to really adapt with the times. They were kind of the revolutionaries within the Catholic Church compared to kind of the authority structure of the priesthood. And so they began to adapt, and they just sent monks to the cities. Well, they didn't have any structure to support themselves and no land to farm, so what did they do? They begged. So that is the term mendicant monks means begging monks who lived in the cities and begged for their subsistence, and in some sense they would provide prayer, ministry, and other things for the donations that were given to them. I don't have time to talk that much about the Franciscan monks and the Dominican monks, but they were both begging monks. They were orders that were, they took vows of poverty, and they did this kind of ministry. However, the Franciscan monks, their main thing was poverty. They reveled in their poverty. They made it so that their monasteries could never really own them, the physical place. The Pope owned it, or the church owned it. They did not own it. They didn't have full control over it. They were only allowed to use it. So absolute poverty, they kind of had poverty as a means to itself. However, the Dominicans, they emphasized other things. They emphasized not withdrawing from the people. They tended to be out and among the people. They lived in the cities. They did ministry. They tried to convert people of other religions, for example, the Muslims and the Jews. One of the reasons that they rose to prominence was because they were they refuted heretics. And so some of the heretics would attack the church because the church was so stinking rich. And so they took vows of poverty so that they could demonstrate that, you know, the way of Christianity was a way of simplicity. And they used that to refute those heretics. But once the need for that poverty was done, once they had kind of won the battle over those heretics, they did acquire property for their various monasteries. And they also emphasized study. So they would have been many of the ones really studying the scriptures, copying the scriptures, studying theology, and those kinds of things. And they were some of the first Dominican monks, were some of the first professors in the new universities in Paris and in London and in other places around the world. So they would have been, they emphasized study. Bernard of Clairvaux was a Dominican monk, and you may have heard his name before. He was their most famous early monk. Any comments on this, their sort of their changing approach to doing Catholic ministry? Go ahead. The Franciscan health system has named itself for Saint Francis of Assisi. But probably that original hospital, which is the original hospital St. Anthony's? Is that the reason that we have a Franciscan health around here? It probably was begun by Franciscan monks. Or it might have been absorbed by an organization that is related to the Franciscan monks. Yeah. So, just like in the South, you have Baptist hospitals, and there's Methodist up in Maryville. There's, you know, the Catholics have done many, many, many hospitals and networks now, health networks. Okay. Anything else? Other comments or questions? Okay. So now there's, and we saw how the Pope sort of bested the emperor. Now we're going to continue to see a growing level of power in the papacy. So Innocent III, whose dates you have there, he became the most powerful pope in all of history. He claimed that the relationship between religion and civil authority was like the relationship of the sun and the moon. So just like the moon receives its light and only reflects the light of the sun, the civil authorities received their power from the religious authority, which was him, right? And he continued this sort of drive to accumulate power. And he constantly, I mean constantly, intervened in politics. He would excommunicate an emperor. He would condemn them to hell, you know, just almost at the drop of a hat. He arranged all kinds of things. He got involved in imperial marriages. He made one emperor, I believe it was the emperor of France. He had divorced, his first wife died. He divorced his second wife. He took a third wife. And the Pope made him go back to his second wife. And she claimed that it was absolute torture to be married to him. She didn't want to be married to him anyway. And so constantly intervening in politics and the emperor's personal lives and all kinds of stuff. His interventions, he was really hard on the Emperor of France, but then he kind of let the King of England off easy for some reason, even though his marital issues were much more unconventional than the King or the Emperor of France. But he let him off kind of easy because he needed him. He needed the power of the British king. However, the nobility of England rose up and they forced the king to sign the Magna Carta, which, you know, we feel like many of our freedoms that we trace back to England really go back to the Magna Carta. Well, the Magna Carta didn't do much for ordinary people like us, but it gave the nobility freedom and power to balance the king's power. And the Pope didn't like that, but he was too far away and not strong enough to intervene. So the Magna Carta stands in that situation. Pope Innocent also called for the Fourth Lateran Council, and which brought into codified sort of law, church law, what they would call canon law. It brought several things that you will find familiar. The doctrine of transubstantiation. It condemned any reform movements like the Waldensians, the Albigensians, and others. We eventually will come back. What we really want to talk about here is some of these people who were like reformers before the time of the Reformation, and the Waldensians were some of those. He ended the forming of any new monastic orders, so you can't start a new one any longer. It has to be within the umbrella of all the ones that already exist. It required the papal approval of introducing any new relics because they were just being flooded. I mean, they had enough. I mean, as I think, as Martin Luther said, there were enough pieces of that cross to finish building St. Peter's Basilica if they would just gather them all up. They were being flooded with all of these fake relics. He also required, or this Fourth Lateran Council required, all Jews and Muslims to wear clothing that distinguished them from the other citizens of Europe, from the Christians, so that they were then targets of discrimination and worse. Priests were no longer allowed to charge for administering communion, and it established something called an Episcopal Inquisition, which meant that bishops were required to look for heresy in their midst and to seek to extinguish it. Okay, so this all leads to bad stuff, okay? It leads to discrimination and persecution of religious minorities. It, it is just an absolute mess. And Pope Innocent was able to get all of this passed in 3 days, which means that it was a rubber stamp process. You know, he got these people behind closed doors and said, sign now, you know, and they brought all of that into canon law. So again, the increase of the power of the Pope is, we're just seeing that going on and on. Any comments or questions? I don't know. I think he is after. I know that the Church of England didn't start until after the Reformation in Germany. I'm pretty sure. So we have run out of time, so we will start with theological activity next week. I really wanted to get to that point because there are some things that came up theologically in this period of time that either influence us or that we just flat out believe. Anselm of Canterbury sort of spoke in terms that would be very, very familiar to us about the incarnation of the Lord Jesus Christ. Peter Lombard is kind of a systematic theologian, so some of you guys will remember that we did systematic theology. We started with the doctrine of God, then the doctrine of man, then, you know, perhaps the doctrine of creation, or we may have done that in the doctrine of God. We talked about the doctrines of the revelation, the Word of God. We talked about salvation, Christ, the Holy Spirit. Those categories, we trace most of that back to the beginning of that was Peter Lombard. We will probably relatively quickly cover that next week and then move on from there. Any comments or questions? What are the lessons that we can learn? Go ahead. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. It just, you know, that those who are supposed to be the representatives of His Son, the Lord Jesus Christ, they claim to be His representatives doing this kind of stuff is really a horror. And doing so, you know, like the Crusades, doing so in the name of the church is really grieving to God. Yeah. Right. Yes, it is. It's the grace of God that Christianity survived itself. And again, you know, what I very much want to do is just kind of hurry up and get through all of this stuff, so that we can talk about a couple of things that are of much more interest to us. So there were people who started these little movements. So I believe it was a guy named Peter Waldo who started the Waldensians. And they were kind of like a cult. They would have been viewed like a cult by the Catholics, but to us they would have been much like, you know, closer to us. I mean, they weren't exactly like us, but they would have been much closer to our way of thinking about Christianity. And then John Huss and others, John Wycliffe, those who began to emphasize the Bible, began to emphasize God's Word, began to emphasize salvation by grace early on, and maybe in a limited kind of way, but nevertheless, we'll have a lesson about what we might call the proto-reformers, who were sort of stoking the fires of genuine reformation and genuine renewal before Martin Luther. So, anything else? Any other comments? All right. Well, thanks for listening in, and we'll be done for now.